I'd like to offer a few reflections tonight, just to hopefully support us in our coming to the end of our first day. And in built into that reflection will be the opportunity for those to enter the ceremony or the gesture of release, if any of you wish to partake in this gesture. I wanted to start tonight by reflecting on a chant that is chanted daily in many of the Buddhist monasteries. And when I have practiced with the monks and nuns in those traditions, this would be some of the daily chant that I'd like to start with, to give us some framework or reminders of framework for those who've been around a while to land our experience with. So in this particular daily chant, they begin by making homage to the Buddha. So there's chants of making offerings to the Buddha and praising the Buddha's qualities, paying homage to the teachings, lifting up the beautiful qualities in the teachings, paying homage to the community of practitioners and lifting up the beautiful qualities. And then it goes on to reflect on some of the teachings, some of the core teachings that they chant every day so that they're like tracks in their mind that they can orient to. That's why those practices of chanting and liturgy and things that allow the mind to, know what tracks to go down. Because the mind, tell me if yours is otherwise, but it can go down all kinds of tracks, and some of them we didn't even know we voluntarily went down there, because we didn't. We just went down there with a momentum of a pattern and a habit that God knows where it began. Yeah. So this is one of the ones, and they get to the part where they reflect on dukkha. And dukkha is the word many of you will know in the tradition that is sometimes translated as suffering, but perhaps more accurately as unsatisfactoriness. Something has got a kind of dis-ease. And the gist of this chant is, that's not your fault. It doesn't say that. They didn't need to say that in the chant, but this is how it goes. It says, what is dukkha? And then you chant three things. Dukkha is association with what is disliked. Dukkha is separation from what is liked. Dukkha is not attaining one's wishes. Full stop. Does it sound familiar? Association with the disliked, having to be in contact with things that are unwanted, internally or externally, coming into a group of new group of 55 people, 24 hours, if you haven't had that experience yet, I would be really surprised. Being in contact with what is disliked, something's just not right here. You know, the teachers aren't right, my roommate's not right, my mind's not right, my body's not right. I just don't like it. Something is disliked here. Yeah. Separation from the liked. To come here, probably we had to separate from what is liked. And if the thought has occurred to you, I'd rather be home with my cat. Someone's looking guilty. It would be very normal. But whatever it is, and that's a really kind of, you know, small version in a sense. Separation from the liked is deep for us. We love and we lose, whether that's sooner or later. And not attaining one's wishes is dukkha. I came here for ease and bliss, and actually I feel worse than I did yesterday when I got here. I didn't come here for knee pain. I didn't come here for a crazy mind, painful body. I wanted something other than I'm finding here. So this gist is a really important part of the predicament, not of a retreat, but of our life. And in a way, when we come to retreat, we can't sort of move away from that. It's not the only thing that happens here, but I really want to name this part because this is typically what gives us the motivation and the inspiration. It's like there must be something more than this kind of bondage or this tangle with my mind fighting with what I like, what I don't like, what I'm separated from. Am I going to get it? I'm not getting it. I had it. I lost it. I want it again. And that kind of pinball where our mind is completely wedded with the conditions of what is agreeable to us or disagreeable to us. So what about that? We didn't call, as you notice, we didn't call the retreat come here to be separated from what you liked, associated with what you dislike, and not get what you want. Because most people wouldn't come. And it's not the only deal, it's not the only thing going here, but it's a really important thing to kind of turn towards. And that chant, those tracks in the mind, you know, when I've had the most difficult times in my life, because I had chanted it so much, that's what I turn to. It's like, oh, this is the realm, this human realm is the realm where if you get it together, you don't get it together for very long. Whatever it is you got together, it's not your fault. It's not the realm that is here to satisfy me. This is not the deal here. So what about that? What we can see and what the Buddha in his compassion and brilliance pointed to is that, yes, these are some of the predicaments. And we can see how the mind and the attention, it almost kind of glues on to this predicament that seems to arise as if we're sort of victim of it. And there we're glued to it and our mind starts spinning with it. It's not just, oh, this is disagreeable to my heart. This, it goes to, what did they do wrong? What did I do wrong? Who's to blame here? What am I going to do about it? Kind of rolling up our sleeves and either ready to fight or backing off in fear. And I'm painting very broad strokes here, but you know how the human mind works. Or probably this is familiar. So given that the mind bonds, sticks, and not only sticks, we kind of spin more trouble for ourselves. Have any of you ever noticed how something started off, you know, you picked up something innocently in your mind and then it spins. And then suddenly you're in a really, really difficult place in your mind. Right? We're learning here to unbind the tangle, this sticky tangle that spins. Learning the skill to unbind the tangle. Learning the understandings that support the unbinding of the tangle. And this opens up an entirely other view. So I would like to read a question somebody wrote me on a note today and actually reflect on that as we continue. So this person wrote, I won't say their name, so don't worry if you, it's a pretty helpful question. They said, I found the phrase that you used yesterday powerful. This was the one about the Buddha as having an appropriate response. I'm struggling to understand this, and I think understanding this is the key for my practice. And then they say, is having an appropriate response, is it the cognitive part, they say, of knowing what's best to do? Is it the emotional part of feeling an appropriate response? Being less reactive, more balanced, tuned, calm? Or is it the behavioral response, the action, doing the right thing even when you feel confused? And then they say, maybe faking it until you make it is maybe faking it before you make it mentally, they say. So I'd like to reflect on that. Clearly the reflection points to different aspects of our human experience. And I'm going to use their categories and kind of shape them into a kind of Buddhist version of those categories and hopefully shed some light on that. So one similar set of categories you find of three in the Buddhist tradition is about the action of our body, so as they said, the body action. Speech, so the articulation, not only that comes out, but the speech we do internally here, right? Body, speech, articulation, and mind. And mind in the Buddhist tradition is this whole sensitive arena of being resonant where we're impacted by each other, by the world, where we feel things, we resonate, we pulsate, and we impact. We invariably impact the other resonators that are here. So body, which I'm doing that, but sometimes in the tradition you see body, right? Body, the whole thing. Speech and mind, and you'll see the pointing here. Body, speech, and mind. So action isn't necessarily active. Action, the body is always expressing an action. We're always expressing an action. So action could be demonstrating on the streets, absolutely. Action could be sitting still. This is an action, it's expressing something. Action can be getting up in the morning, caring for my sick friend, answering my emails, not answering my emails. Right? Action, there's always an action being expressed here. Articulation or this speech, and the person said, is it the cognitive part, like the knowing what to do? Yes. And actually from the Buddha's appropriate response is all of them, all of a piece, all wrapped together and informing each other, the body, speech and mind, working together as one body. So this articulation, this speech, including the inner speech, never, ever, ever operates aside from the body and the mind. Sometimes our mindfulness can only see the bit at the top. This is where I'm pointing. The bit that's the thought that says, oh, blimey, I'm going to have this, oh, I have to, whatever. Whatever your mind says, oh, blimey, about. Right? Oh no. Right? We see the words, they're crisp, they're chiseled, or they did this. He shouldn't have said that. I'm never going to have. Why doesn't anybody? I'll never get it. Right? We might see that part. But what we know now is, not only from the Dhamma, but at some of the branches of neuroscience now, showing something really interesting, that the image they give, one of the images I like, is this: what comes as a thought, they say, starts off in the body like a spore. Spore is an English word I rarely use. Sounds even funny to me. A spore is the seed of certain kinds of plants that's kind of flat, like a little black disc, if English is... if spore isn't a word, you know. It's like a little disc, like it almost looks two-dimensional. And it's the seed for like a fern. Like a fern will come out of a spore, yes. And they say now, the image they give is like, it's as if that spore of that thought is deep, deep, deep in the body. And we may only see the top of the fern. But as our capacity for sensing the body and sensing the mind, this sensitivity of impacting and being impacted. As the mindfulness deepens there, we can see the fern in its process of us pressing on the spore and the fern rolling up and expressing itself and curling out with the thoughts at the top. It's very possible to train, and I'm sure all of you actually know this, of not having to have certain thoughts or go in certain directions with the mind. It's like, oh, I've been there 100 times before. I'm not going to go there again. And the mind, this being very resonant, meaning we feel we're impacted, we're impactable from each other, from our world, from our times, from our mind. But impactable, do you know what that is? It's like you feel things, you go into a room, you can sense the atmosphere that's there. You can tell somebody just had an argument in there, you're sensitive in that way. That capacity to resonate and to be impacted is not just about trouble and being relationally in trouble. It's like, ooh, don't say that to me. It's actually the basis of the boundless heart. To be able to resonate is to be able to pulsate along with more and more and more and more of our inner life and our outer life without being knocked off course. Being able to be impacted is not only trouble, it's the basis of beauty. Being able to be impacted also means being able to be impacted by our depths, our mysterious, unfathomable, incredible depths. So a Buddha's body, then, one way of seeing this is a body that can make an appropriate response because the body, speech and mind are singing on the same hymn sheet, as they say. They're singing together. And so the impact, the Buddha is impacted by the student and the response is appropriate of action of body, speech and mind. Because they can take that in, they can sense the other where they are without being knocked off course. This is huge, right? That's huge. And this possibility of a Buddha's body, this is not for us to compare ourselves of like, oh blimey, I've just got sore knees. I'm a long way from that. This is something to come into contemplation with, to perhaps admire, to perhaps be inspired by this image of possibility, because probably we know there's more to us than what we've cultivated so far, or else we wouldn't be here, right? So you have enough curiosity or trust or faith or hope or inklings or glimmers or absolute conviction that there's more here for you. And that's the humility of our path and the love of our path. So if this image of the Buddha, of the appropriate response can be someone or an image, where we may want to come closer, or there may be a sense of reverence. They say that the Buddha, people wanted to be around him, right? And you may know people like that. You want to be around them. they might be really ordinary in the world, but you recognize there's something there. There's something there that I want to come closer to. I want to know what you know. I want to know what you know. Right? Something speaks to us of more, and this is the journey. This is the journey. So let us come to the resonant body. And today I reflected on earth body, earth element, this kind of solidity and hardness and this aspect. The resonant body, right? That sometimes as humans, and I know for me for a really long time in my practice, I could kind of get the mind a little bit concentrated, but I didn't have so much capacity to feel the resonance because it had shut down. Because that's the best I could do with the conditions I was given. It had shut down because to resonate, it's not that I absolutely didn't resonate, but it's a spectrum. But I had shut down a lot out of the knocks and the, you know, the conditions. Probably many of you recognize that. Right? Something had closed down, just hardened, was just like a bit more defended or a lot defended. And the practice of breathing in and breathing out and being willing to sit with our own heart and minds, the resonators start to turn on again. Right? They start to switch on again. Some of us may feel like we're way too resonant. It's like, blimey, I feel everything. I feel everything in the world from each other, from... Please show me how to turn my resonators down a little bit. And having the resonators open is beautiful, but we need a similar degree of understanding of the emptiness of the body, that it's this, what Yehel was pointing to this morning, that it's not me, and it's not mine, and where he's pointing us, it's not real in the way I think, but neither is it unreal. The middle way. And from that perspective, then, that sensitivity and resonance has a very, very different ground. So our resonators, if we feel like we have them switched on just too much, we can learn to modulate as well. We can gain more ground. We can gain more skill if we feel overwhelmed by the resonance. So let us turn to the gesture of release. A human body, we're inviting those who wish to come and relinquish your telephones, right? And we can say, and we do, just leave them at the bottom of your suitcase. So why make all this fuss of having a ceremony? From a pragmatic point of view, you just need to switch your phone off and not look at it. That will allow your attention, if your attention usually bonds to your phone, if that becomes your bonding attachment figure, or even if your attention sort of has habits with the phone that don't serve you, like, you know, looking again at that piece of news, like, what is Donald Trump doing today, you know, or has that person messaged me, or do they love me, or shall I scroll that terrible piece of information again to shock myself? Or however your mind in those quiet moments, whatever it does, this sort of activation of ourself. Yeah. From a pragmatic point of view, just turn it off and see the effect and what it liberates for attention, where that can go. But we're not just pragmatic beings. We are relational beings, we are resonant beings, we are cultural beings. We are beings of culture, and we are very affected by every single gesture we make of the body. And this one is, as I said, an echo of the letting go of the monks and nuns, of giving up something they don't have to give up. And to be witnessed by community, it's like we witness your aspiration for practice. We witness your aspiration. It's quite powerful. I may be saying something that's very obvious to you, but ceremony is not really always in fashion in the modern mind. It's like, just turn it off. You don't need to make a fuss. I'll just pay attention to my breath. But to make a gesture of release, witnessed, is, you can see the effect for yourself. It kind of amplifies something. And that willingness to release from our hand into the box can track right back to the heart, to the resonators, and we're available. We're available. So let's do this simply, lightly, but also with respect for the gesture. And those who wish will bring their phones in a minute. We, the rest, can chant for them, or not only for them, but kind of to allow this room to become a place of ceremony. And I invite you to chant with me the four Brahmaviharas. These are the four qualities of the awakened heart as they're outlined in the Buddhist tradition. So the resonators, when we're a little bit more freed up, and it's not further along the way, you will know these tracks already. When we are steady, when we are kindly, we know, each of us here, what an appropriate response is. You don't have to wait till you're a Buddha. Right? You know what it is to find these qualities of kindness and of compassion and of joy and equanimity. So we chant these four in the Pali, and the words are metta, that's kindness, karuna, compassion. Mudita is the joy. And upeka, the balance, the equanimity, the mountain-like, not pushed and pulled by conditions. And if you want to make it just a really simple gesture, put it in. If you want to bow in any way, you can. And then we'll just come up one after the other, assuming there are some. We don't know. I don't know. So if when one comes, you can just kind of queue up or find your way up. You don't have to wait till it's all done before you come up.
Karuna mudita upeka metta karuna mudita upeka metta karuna mudita upeka metta karuna mudita upeka
Metta karuna mudita upeka, 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 metta karuna and sensing whichever action you participated in, if you gave your phone, if you didn't give your phone. Just sense the resonances, the responses in your body, in your heart, if there are any. It's a really perennial gesture of release. That by enacting that through our body, it then can knock back on and affect our heart and our mind. Our work of as a spiritual practitioner isn't only, it is really important, the deep, quiet, contemplative subtlety. Absolutely. And we can see the beauty of how gestures that are lined up with our deepest aspiration kind of knock back on. They have an effect from the body to the mind, to the articulation inner and outer. So sense any of the responses. Giving it or not giving it is all completely fine. There's no right and wrong here. The Dhamma question is, what's the effect of this action? This way of engaging. Is it helpful? Does it lead onward? How are we going to know? Is to sit with the results, including that, oh, I wish I could look at my phone, and hearing that sort of squeak in the mind, feeling the earth element, finding your center, letting that rest. Maybe even letting it cease. I know when I began practice, which is a long time ago now, I'm proud of my modern pragmatic mind, which is beautiful. I mean, not saying my pragmatic mind is beautiful, actually it's not that, it's not always that great, but it's a beautiful thing. I'm not knocking pragmatism at all. But I remember seeing practitioners who were some of my friends bowing and prostrating and it made me kind of wince a little bit, these actions of the body that looked like they were sort of old-fashioned. And I once read, I think it was Immanuel Kant, I can't remember. Somebody asked him, how would you describe the modern mind as it was just coming into sort of fashion? And he said, oh, modern mind is one that if you were in a room and you were bowing and somebody walked in, you would be embarrassed. I was like, oh, yeah. Right. Yeah, I get that. And what I've come to see, I'm not advocating bowing or anything, I'm advocating concrete gesture as part of practice. Not, yes, gestures of kindness, absolutely, but even ones that don't look like they have pragmatic results. Gestures of offering, gestures of release. And somebody once asked one of my teachers, Ajahn Sachito, does anybody know Ajahn Sachito here? You know, and in their practice, he comes in front of the Buddha images every day and makes the chanting and the gestures and the. And somebody said, "Why do you do that?" And he says something like, "When I sit my body up in front of the image of the Buddha and make gesture in that way," he says, "I get to find out where I am in relationship. I get to find out where I am." Because I might wake up in the morning and we're not always up for it, are we? The relationship with someone, the world, our work. It's like, it takes a while to, for some of us. Some of us might roll in enthusiastically. But sometimes it takes a while to kind of adjust from that sleep to the world of relationship. It's like, yes, you get to tune, you get to make that gesture, you get to sit there, you get to make your offerings. You kind of go through what might look like the motions, but sometimes going through the motions can allow the citta to start to resonate, the sensitivity to start to resonate, can remind you of your orientation, can set you up. That's quite pragmatic, actually. Sometimes sometimes an aspect of the modern arrogance, I think, is, and again, I'm not knocking modernism at all, but I have seen this, that sometimes we think abstract things are more important than concrete things. So, you know, a child, when they're learning something, they have to make it concrete, usually, till they don't. And it's seen as an advance when they don't. And it is. There is a kind of, you know, like counting. Like you're learning how to count. You've got the little wooden beads or whatever they are now. Right? You need to make it tangible and concrete. And then when you're, I don't know, 7, and you can do it in your head. And it's like, oh, yes. I can do it in my head. I've reached adulthood. I'm getting to the what's valued, which is to not have to be so concrete and visceral. I can read without speaking out loud now. But there may be, and somebody spoke in the group actually today, you know, about one of these, some of our work in Dhamma as modern people is the healing of the rupture that's happened with bodies and matter. Somebody said today they realized that they were relating to their body as an obstacle to their freedom. Sometimes we can see that we're relating to our body as an object. This modern gaze of being able to get a distance from things and look from afar, and all that that has won us many good things, but it becomes a default. And we abstract to this living, intelligent, visceral Buddha's body. So I just offer this as a thought, that part of, for some of us, the healing can be the humility of the gesture that is concrete, that doesn't look like it has a pragmatic result. I don't say that this is what everybody needs to do, but I certainly find that it opens up pathways of practice that I couldn't get to without it. So I'm going to end now, but with a question for your body. And so if you make your body available as best you can. And by body available, it's like also the resonators, like all our resonators, like this sensitive stuff, which makes it, you know, as we got up from our all fours, this bit that's all kind of open and exposed. It's like, ooh, this bit. And the question for your body, before I ask it for you, and you can, I'm going to use the word in it, lineage. Lineage comes in England, English, from the same word as line, like what line lineage is, like the lines you come from, and it can be, could be ancestral lineages, it could be lineages, those who've come before you, or even not in time, it could be like even present moment lineages of your connections to what you're connected to, that you, when you remember that, you're connected. So lineages typically might be our ancestors, but it can be our spiritual lineages, the teachers, It could be our intellectual lineages, the teachers who've really brightened and pointed the way. Can be lineages of earth or trees or mountains or rivers or certain kinds of beings of more than humans. It could be a being that's not visible to anyone else. I don't know what your body will come up with, but I'm going to ask two questions. And if it doesn't land, don't worry. If there isn't a response, doesn't matter. They may be in time or they may not be your question. But here's the first question. To your body. So I'm speaking to your body as if they are, not even as if they are, but to their intelligence. To your body's intelligent, bright, visceral, sensitive, imaginative, touchable, resonant body. The question is, dear body, who or what are the lineages that you are connected to? Not who you think you should be, but what your body has to say about that. And then your body may offer you an image. It might be a bit left field, it might be really straightforward. Who or what are your lineages? And there might be one. Or several. And the body doesn't always answer in very chiseled, declarative thoughts. They can, but they also respond in images and resonances and curious inklings. And the second question. And if you wanted to make a gesture of offering to affirm your connection to your lineage, what would it be? If you wanted to make a gesture of offering, what might it be? So for some of you, this will be very resonant and obvious. To others of you, like, it won't be. And that's all fine, really fine. And for those for whom it's resonant and meaningful right now, if in the walking period that we'll go to shortly, if you want to make a gesture of offering privately, it would be between you and not any other humans at this point in the retreat. And it might be with you just in your own imagination with your body, but it might be a gesture, concrete gesture, then find a way tonight or tomorrow to engage that, if you wish. Both for the beauty of it, for the experiment of it, for the seeing where it leads, here and now. And for those for whom it's not resonant for you, see if it becomes so, like it kind of might come in the night in your dreams, or it may never need to come. There are many Dharma doors. Find out which ones you enter tonight.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.